worshipping this ancient race, even after the revelation that the San Shayum, who had once led the Covenant, had been false prophets. As Duro's former mentor had often remarked, a god who creates tools is still a god. It is not for us to impose qualifications upon the divine, or presume to guess its intentions. With a dozen of the Pale Blade's warriors at his back, Duron took one last look at Hasduros on either side of the wall, and deeply breathed in the air. Then gripping his carbine tightly, he pressed forward and threw caution aside, putting his fate in the hands of the Forerunners. Dural turned to Rook and Burren as he approached. "May I see you on the other side?" The light swallowed him whole, its brightness drowning out all else. It felt like millions of fingers, or perhaps cilia, like those at the ends of the tentacles of a Hurrigok, were pressing into his flesh and then tugging it apart. The sensation was somehow not painful, although he could not say he cared for it. A moment later, unsure how much time had passed, Dural emerged inside what was clearly a Forerunner structure, an interior that looked much like many of those he had visited on other worlds. Smooth gray walls, floors, and ceilings formed into vaulted spaces with long lines of lighting embedded throughout. Dural could have been anywhere, on any of the countless planets the Forerunners had visited and left their inscrutable mark. But it certainly resembled the place Jewel M'Dama had once described as the temple through which he had escaped the shield world. The place the humans called Onyx. After a long moment, the others eventually came filing in after Dural. Rook came first, and Burren followed close on his heels, both shivering briefly as they recovered from the effects of the journey. Rook glanced around the area and shook his head in disbelief. "Tally yet another victory for the Pale Blade and his bravery. To think we have made it all the way to this most glorious facility, the one the ancient texts spoke so highly about." Burren hissed, "And without the humans being made aware of our presence, let us see how long we can keep it that way." "Do you fear taking on the humans, Elder Burren?" Rook said. "I fear us giving away our hard-won advantages without cause." Dural stepped between the two of them, "which is precisely why I asked only a dozen more warriors to come through with us for the time being. We must scout the area before we send back for the others." "Gods preserve us," Burren said as he peered around the chamber. "Are you certain coming here was right, Pale Blade?" Burren glanced about as if the ceiling might suddenly come to life and fall on him. Then the older Sangheili became transfixed by the ancient symbols that glowed on the walls. He stumbled toward one in particular, taken by its beauty, yet fatally distracted and open to attack.
"Good to see an old warrior like that give himself over to the faith," Rook commented.
"His preoccupation with mere machines exposes him to injury," Dural said, checking his own armor to ensure it still functioned. Rook looked at Dural sidelong.
"Are you giving voice to doubts in the gods? After having traveled through that?"
Rook pointed back toward the gate, through which the remainder of the advanced strike team was still streaming one at a time.
"I have no doubts about our mission, our warriors, or our gods," Dural said in a loud voice. "I only have doubt in blind faith. The servants of the abiding truth hold a faith that is well-founded because we have seen what the Forerunners left behind. They did this for the benefit of those who would follow, so we should not doubt what we have seen. Yet we should take care to not be overwhelmed in the present at the cost of the future. We all know how well such foolishness among our people served the Arbiter, when he sought to set Sangheili brothers against each other."
Burren snorted at that and turned from studying the symbols, seemingly freed from his trance.
"Would you have refused to withdraw from the Covenant then, when the prophets betrayed us?"
"We did not leave the Covenant," Dural said, his voice a low growl.
"The Covenant left us. If Durrell was honest, however, he knew there was truth to Burren's remark. Many of the people of M'Dama had already begun to give up on the Covenant late during the war. By the time Durrell's mother, Rhea M'Dama, had died, the ancient rites outlined by the San Shayum had meant nothing to him anymore. Following the prophets had been the epitome of blind faith for his people, which is perhaps why he despised it so. Still, Durrell wanted a reason to believe, even as a child, and his mother's death had led him to that. It happened at the start of the Blooding Years, when Jewel M'Dama, both Durrell's uncle and the Kaidan of Bacon Keep, where Durrell was hatched and raised, plotted with the servants of the Abiding Truth. Their efforts were simple. A full-fledged naval attack against the Arbiter and his native forces on San Helios. During the days leading up to their strike, though, his uncle was lost. And when Jewel went missing, Durrell's mother Rhea left the keep, following in his wake, hoping to find him. Instead, she found Fieldmaster Avumed Telkam, and then demanded to follow the Sangheili leader as he initiated the assault. Rhea was on the frigate Cleansing Faith when it was shot down during a battle with the swordsman, the personal cruiser of the Arbiter himself. Only later did Durrell discover that Jewel had survived, but the Sangheili leader never returned to Bacon Keep. Naxon, an elder and great-uncle in Durrell's clan, was forced to take over in Jewel's absence. The moment Durrell could manage it, however, he went looking for Jewel himself. He refused to be abandoned by the only true leader his keep had left. Reflecting, Durrell wondered if he should have simply stayed at Bacon Keep. But the swords of San Helios knew of the connections between the servants of the Abiding Truth and his family's estate. It would have been foolish for them not to make an example of Bacon once they had the chance. And after the death of his mother, Durrell only had one other family member he trusted, his brother Asim. But even he stayed only for a time. Distraught over their mother's death, Asim went off into the fields around Bacon Keep to grieve. And that was the last time Durrell saw his brother. Asim never returned, though Durrell did not stay long enough to know his fate for certain. In the end, it mattered little. Durrell had already made his decision. Left alone in those moments to contemplate his purpose, Durrell pledged to follow in his mother's footsteps and try to finish the task she had begun, to find Jewel M'Dama wherever he might have gone. But after the failure of the servant's initial assault on the Arbiter, there was no way to tell what had happened to Jewel. Only the barest of clues existed. Jewel had reached out to Naxon in the days after the passing of Rhea, sending a message from a remote world. Where that had been, and what his ultimate plans were, Durrell still did not know. In the years that followed, Durrell searched the Outer Lands for his uncle and asked about Asim as he did. But he never found any trace of either. It was as if they had both been plucked from San Helios by the gods. It was in those days, however, that Durrell found his purpose, to join and fight alongside the servants of the Abiding Truth. While under the guidance of Fieldmaster Avumed Telkam, learning the path of the warrior, Durrell still kept an eye out for Jewel M'Dama and for Asim. Jewel did not resurface until years later, now at the head of what he referred to as his Covenant, a burgeoning reformation, but now without the San Shayum's oversight. By this time, Durrell had already been blooded in battle several times over, fighting on the front lines of the servant's inexorable push against the swords of San Helios. The rumors that flooded in from the Fieldmaster's sources indicated that Jewel had spent a great deal of time on Hesduros, far from the eyes of the Arbiter, building up his resurgent Covenant one ship at a time. When Durrell first noted this, he contacted Naxon, who then told Durrell something his mother had never shared with him, something that would irrevocably shatter his world. Durrell was Jewel M'Dama's birth son. And not only that, but Jewel already possessed this knowledge. Jewel knew that Durrell, whom he had left in Bacon, was his child.
In the Sangheili tradition, children were all raised together by the keep's females, who never let the fathers know who their fledglings might be. This time-honored practice was meant to keep the parents from showing their children any bloodline favoritism, giving them an egalitarian society in which people had to earn any reward on their own merits, rather than having anything granted. For the most part, it worked extremely well. But Rhea had loved Jewel so much that she had broken the taboo and shared the identity of his sons with him. It was a foolish choice, and one that had wound up causing Dorol great pain. Yet, with this new light, came new choices. Should he abandon the servants of the Abiding Truth and Avu Med Telkam and set out for the redoubts his real father had built on Hesduros? Or should he remain loyal to the one Sangheili who had played the role of father to him during his most formative years? It did not take long for Dorol to measure the scales. Jewel N'Dama had knowingly abandoned both Dorol and Asim to rot in Bacon Keep, while he hid from the Arbiter's wrath and dishonored Rhea's death. When Dorol finally realized this, he became enraged. If he did set out to Hesduros, it would not be for reunion, but for revenge. Only the Fieldmaster was able to persuade Dorol to not hunt Jewel down and demand blood satisfaction for his dereliction. Instead, Telkam placed Dorol on the path to where they now stood. Onyx, the great refuge of the Forerunners. Today had been the culmination of long years of pain and anger. And now, finally, Dorol was here. "Yes," Dorol repeated. "The Covenant left us. Do you think Jewel N'Dama and his forces, which he foolishly refers to as the Covenant, would have had the vision or the resources to come here? They were on Hesduros for years, and yet they spent their days in hiding, fighting over scraps rather than returning here into the embrace of the Forerunner's greatest treasure." Burin huffed to the side. "I still think there is wisdom in leaving well enough alone. Your uncle was the only one to have seen what was on the other side of this portal. Perhaps there was a good reason for him to have refused to return. This shield world houses more Forerunner machines, both weapons and vehicles, than any other place in the galaxy," Dorol responded. Burin's testing grated on him, although he had grown used to it. "You've read the script, Burin." "Yes, the humans have infested it, and their numbers here grow daily. What better reason to act quickly? They are already desecrating all that the Forerunners left behind, many of them working alongside the Arbiter's own clans to do it. And if they are not stopped, what do you think they might do with the machines they find here?"
Burin appeared bewildered at this. "Our people have a head start of centuries on their efforts. We have been exploring the majesty of the Forerunners for ages, before the humans even knew they existed."
"Perhaps." Dorol approached Burin's face to exert his authority. "According to what the Fieldmaster himself learned before his death, the humans have gathered their best researchers here and unleashed them to this very end. They are pulling apart this world stone by stone, defiling the temples of the Forerunners in order to deliver the very weapons and ships of the gods into the hands of our enemies."
"What heresy and blasphemy!" Rook spat. "How much longer must we be forced to stomach such treachery? The Arbiter and his allies must die."
Dorol was about to voice his agreement when even Keel finally came through the gate. With the Huragok now here, the servants' advance team was complete. From what the Fieldmaster had told Dorol, which he had heard from contacts close to Jewel N'Dama himself, the Forerunner temple they had accessed stood within 20 or so kilometers of the humans' main base within the Shield world. This intelligence, however, was from roughly 5 years ago. Who knew what the humans have done since then? In any case, this location lay far too close to the human base. Not in the least because the humans might be monitoring the place at that very moment. As far as Durul was concerned, it had been a matter of sheer providence that no humans had been in this temple upon their arrival. The servants needed to set up their own camp soon, but in a different area, somewhere from which they could safely stage their scouting efforts. Durul beckoned the Huragok forward, and it floated to his side. The bizarre creature communicated natively with its sign language, but with the servants it employed an older technology recovered from Covenant vessels, which simultaneously translated its signs. Via the circuits built into Durul's armor, even Kiel could understand him, and he could interpret its sign language through the collar he wore. "We need to set up a base on this shield world," Durul said. "Can you alter the portal to have it bring us to a defensible site within the sphere? One far enough from the humans who have infested this place?"
"It is possible," even Keel's surrogate voice chimed in Durrell's collar. "I must evaluate this side of the gate."
"See to it, Huragok. I want to keep it within a safe striking distance, though, for when the time of our attack has come."
Even Kiel set to work immediately.
"I do not like this," Burren said, nodding at the Huragok. "We are far too dependent on this single engineer. What happens if he is injured?"
"Or killed," Durul heard in Burren's voice. Durul would have also added, "or betrays us." Either was a possibility in this place. "Once we set up camp and ferry in the rest of our warriors, our singular goal is finding other Huragok within the sphere and taking them for our own. They are the key to the Forerunner prize we seek."
"And what if the Nishum already have those Huragok in their employ?" said Rook, using the Sangheili invective for the human species. "If the humans have been here as long as you say, they must have captured some of the creatures and put them to work."
"I hope for that to be true," Durul said.
"That would mean they likely have more than one together at a time, which makes them easier targets. Also, stealing their Huragok would not only help us, but would hurt them as well."
Rook made an affirmative grunt. A moment later, even Kiel indicated that it had found a safe location. It surprised even Burren, who seemed to be losing his grit in this place. It was likely too much for the old Sangheili to process. As Durul approached, Kiel gestured for him to enter the portal once more. Durul moved quickly toward it without hesitation, motioning for the others to follow.
"You are in charge of the Huragok," Durul said to Rook, turning his back to Burren. "Stay here until I send someone to fetch you. And if you do not return?"
Durul barked a harsh laugh at him.
"I do not plan for failure, Rook. Stay vigilant."
As Durul walked through the portal, the sensation this time was not nearly as unpleasant, perhaps because he was not traveling quite so far. It felt as if he were moving through a thick veil of webs, but the feeling quickly passed. And Durul emerged inside another Forerunner facility. In many ways it resembled the one he had just left, but was far wider and taller, vaguely similar to some of the Forerunner structures back home, in the city of Antom. It seemed to be a vast containment facility of some sort, but no doubt had spiritual significance. He sighed when he examined the portal and realized that this machine was also too small to transport his vehicles through. He would have to wait for that victory. Then Durul heard a rumble, the muffled sounds of battle. This was not the comforting sound of elegant Sangheili weaponry launching blasts of superheated plasma, but the discordant rattle of automatic gunfire, the kind the humans produced in war. Somewhere outside the large structure, humans shouted at each other in a tongue Durul recognized as one of their primary languages. He could not speak it, but the translator in his armor untangled their unseemly babble into something coherent. Some of them shouted orders, others cried out in terror and panic. For a moment, Durul worried that they had somehow detected the servant's arrival at the temple site and were headed to his warrior's position. But the situation was not about him or the servants who remained at the other site. It was about something entirely different. Somewhere outside the structure, among the shouters and shooters,
A massive creature bellowed in agony until its voice trailed off into nothingness. The warriors of Dural's splinter team finished appearing behind him, and he signaled for each of them to take cover and keep silent. If the humans were occupied with another foe, perhaps a native animal of some sort, then this presented the servants with a prime opportunity to strike an unsuspecting enemy. The humans might never be so distracted again. On the other hand, whatever the humans were fighting could also pose a problem. It might well be such a dangerous animal that Dural would be risking his entire scouting team. Despite his eagerness to engage the wretched human foes as soon as possible, he had no desire to bury his entire operation in the ground during their first hours here in the shield world. After he quickly surveyed their surroundings, Dural noticed that, apart from the portal, the room had only one entrance. He signaled for his team to fan out to either side of it, a large aperture that was far enough away so that anyone coming down the long, wide corridor leading into the chamber could not see them. At that very moment, Dural heard a pair of voices coming toward the far end of the hallway. Even without his translator, he could understand their tone and inflection because the Fieldmaster had forced him to learn it, despite his natural aversion to their speech. These humans were clearly scared. Avumed Telkam had allied himself with humans in the past, faithless ones eager to betray the Arbiter, and he expected Dural to be able to do the same when Telkam was gone. He had no love for the frail and sickly mammals, but communicating with them had ultimately proved a necessary evil. Dural had bucked against the learning of the language, but he knew enough to understand it, with the translation device filling in the gaps. It would have been a far worse sin to avoid the humans and let the Arbiter and his allies triumph over all Sanghelios. Though in the aftermath of Telkam's death, Dural often wondered if the Fieldmaster had been mistaken about the necessity. After all, a demon, one of the soldiers the humans called Spartans, had finally hunted down and killed him. "What the hell was that?" a female of the human band said. "Some kind of land shark?" How odd that the humans let their females fight beside them. How desperate for help must they be. Yet Dural had heard rumors of female Sangheili fighting within the Arbiter's own ranks. Another blasphemy the traitor had picked up from his human allies. "It wasn't friendly, whatever it was," the male replied. "The creatures here were harvested from other planets across the galaxy. They could have come from anywhere." "Why don't you give that cold-hearted lecture to Trevor?" the female said. "Better yet, you can tell his wife and kids once we get back to Pax." Dural leaned in to listen closer. The humans spoke of families rather than forces, and Dural wondered exactly what kind of humans had been brought there to explore this world. Perhaps there were far more researchers than even he had considered, and far fewer warriors. That might explain why these people had apparently struggled so hard to defeat the beast that had attacked them. It also meant his forces could make easy work of them. "They knew the risks when they came here," the male said, irritated. "We all did." "Risks?" The female let out a bitter laugh. "We came here to explore alien archaeology, not to get torn to pieces by a face full of razor-sharp teeth. Nobody wanted Trevor to die. Sometimes when you're wandering around a strange planet and not following protocol, really bad things happen. Inside a place like Onyx, that's bound to be even more true." "That's the best excuse you can come up with? Things happen? I can't wait for you to try to sell that to your superior officer." Dural wondered if the male, at least, might be a soldier. That would make more sense, even if Dural could not understand why he would bring a female along. They did not belong anywhere near the field of battle. Dural's mother served as hard proof of that. Rhea should have stayed at the keep with him and his brother. If she had, she might still be alive. "If you and the rest of your research team want to get out of here in a better condition than Trevor, I suggest you fall in line and head for the portal back to the repository before that thing's friends come back looking for it." "We're not leaving Trevor's body here for the animals," another male voice called from farther back.
Then you need to grab it fast, the soldier said. Those portals aren't always stable for long, and the clock's ticking on our window to get back.
If the humans had come here via the portal, then Dural and the servants clearly stood between them and their only means of escape.
Dural motioned for his warriors to ready their weapons.
Burin put a hand on Dural's shoulder and gave him a wary look.
No need to alert the humans to our presence quite yet, he whispered. We can be gone before they even know we are here.
Dural shrugged off the elder with a glare that told him the next time he presumed to put his hand on the pale blade, it would be returned broken.
The sound of footsteps coming down the corridor toward the servants echoed into the chamber, and Dural nodded toward the others. When he judged the pair to be halfway toward the main contingent of their splinter group, he gave the signal to attack.
Dural gripped his carbine and led the charge down the corridor, firing upon the pair of humans who had frozen in their tracks. They might have been wary of more monsters attacking them outside, but they had not suspected they might run into a troop of fully armed Sangheili warriors within the structure.
"Cut them down!" Dural shouted as one of his bolts struck true and felled the female weakling.
Although he had briefly fought humans in the past, the bulk of his engagements had been against fellow Sangheili. Technically, she was the first human Dural had ever killed in battle, and he swore in that moment that he would always remember that. She would not be the last on this campaign. Countless others would fall before him, but she would not be forgotten.
"Make sure no human escapes," Dural shouted as his warriors mowed down the soldier and charged up the corridor to seek out any other prey. "Tonight marks the end of their dominion over this shield world. We shall take it for the servants of the abiding truth. We shall take it for the Fieldmaster."
Chapter 9. With Asha and Yong's expertise on the mysterious Forerunner machines attached to Project Goliath, whatever that was, the two were in high demand by Oni analysts. This meant Molly didn't get to spend too much time adjusting to Onyx from the comfort of her new home. Within a few days after the family's arrival, her new parents sent her to the school, and she was bored enough by then that she decided not to fight it. But boredom, she soon discovered, was the lesser of two evils. Molly almost immediately hated the school in Paxopolis, also known as the Pax Institute. This was not Aranuka by any stretch. For example, when she surveyed the dining hall, which one expected to be innocent enough given the overarching purpose of the city and its peaceful researchers, Molly instead found it packed with hundreds of angst-riddled, mercurial kids who seemed to be perpetually in unruly moods. Despite the allegedly idealistic purpose of Paxopolis, its school had all of the bad ingredients of a normal school on any other human planet. Possibly even more so. Then again, Molly didn't care for most other schools she'd attended either. It wasn't that she didn't get good grades. She actually performed remarkably well, but she just couldn't stand most of the teachers or the others. She could never connect with them, and that frustrated her to no end. When Molly lived in Wisconsin, she was only seen as the refugee, the kid who'd survived the glassing of her planet. Everyone who found out about Paris 4 would give her the same sad, pitiful look, as if the person knew her and her story. But Molly didn't want special attention or sympathy. She just wanted to fit in, to blend in with the crowd, to be normal, whatever that meant. Molly liked most of the people she knew there, but it seemed that they were so cut off from the war that it didn't mean much to them, to most of Earth before the Covenant showed up. The war was out of sight and out of mind. True, some of them had volunteered to fight against the Covenant, and Molly applauded their bravery for that. Yet the people she knew in Wisconsin, of course, were the ones who'd stayed home, who knew the least about what was going on in the colonies as the Covenant wiped out one world after another. Maybe they did what they could to support the war effort, but as far as Molly was concerned, it was hard to know what you were supporting unless you saw it firsthand. To most of Earth, the war was both literally and emotionally light years away. It was always someone else's problem.
Plus, by the time Molly started living in Wisconsin, the war had already been going on for 24 years. An entire generation had grown up under the looming shadow of an interstellar invasion by an alien force armed with superior technology. That was all they had. The adults who knew about the time before the war would never understand Molly's generation. Not truly. The war was the backstory of their entire lives. But Molly was the only one in her Wisconsin town who'd actually experienced it in person, for whom war wasn't just background, but the darkest chapter of her life. When Molly moved to Aranuka, she'd hoped for a better time at school. Unlike in Wisconsin, she had something vital in common with her neighbors there. They'd been through a Covenant invasion and survived. The sudden and traumatic attack of Earth had put them all on a level playing field. Molly hoped there would be some kindred spirits she could connect to and relate with. But that never happened. Many of the kids she went to school with hadn't been in Aranuka during the actual invasion or even seen the Covenant's destruction outside of news feeds. Like Molly, they'd come with their families from relatively secure locations to fill the massive hole the attack on the space tether had created. Many places on Earth had remained untouched by the Covenant, and the majority of these citizens had come from such locations. At the time, Molly figured she could at least bond with the ones who had been somewhere directly attacked during the Covenant's invasion, even if that was on Mars or Luna, both of which were also ravaged during the assault. But a crucial difference kept cropping up. While even those people had all survived alien invasions, Molly hadn't been around for their experience. They already had plenty of friends they'd formed a trauma bond with in the aftermath of their particular Covenant attacks. And despite her hopes for friendships, they never welcomed Molly into their groups. Some even showed animosity when she tried to find her way in. Their differences in experience had created even more challenging barriers than before. Ironically, Molly found herself more alone in Aranuka than she had been in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, the people had tried to bring her into the fold, even if it was out of some kind of botched effort toward sympathy. In Aranuka, everyone immediately expected her to be part of a different group because of where she'd come from and what she'd been through. But no one had been through what Molly had, which meant she didn't have a group. She just had herself. Molly didn't know how that was going to work in Onyx, but given all of her apprehensions about the place, she didn't have high hopes. Still, she would put on a brave face for her new parents. Mostly because a large part of her had abandoned any hope for a normal life the moment she'd met Kashaw Highland. Also, it had become clear over the past few days that her new parents had enough to deal with, adjusting to their new jobs and the urgency that seemed to attend Project Goliath. Fortunately for Molly, she'd arrived near the start of a new school session, so she didn't have much catching up to do. It was October back on Earth. And although Onyx's natural calendar, if such a thing could be conceived of, didn't match up with Earth's, the research community's policy was to observe military standard time, which was, at least in theory, universal across all UNSC sites. Pax Institute featured an odd mixture of architectural styles drawn from humans, Sangheili, and Forerunners. Parts of the education facility seemed to be designed to make all species feel at home, which Molly admitted was a strangely impressive task. The building complex featured large spaces with high ceilings. Many of them had no ceilings or roofs at all, and stood open to the sky. Or so it seemed to the naked eye. The colors of the school tended toward neutral, pale grays and purples with highlights of glowing blue lights that seemed to suffuse every room. The interior doors were made of a kind of transparent barrier that activated and deactivated when someone approached them. And the walls, even the interior ones, had long windows so one could see people moving all about one at any time. Some of these qualities may have simply been for aesthetic purposes, or to present a comfortable egalitarian atmosphere in which very different species could coexist. Knowing Oni probably had a hand in the school's design, Molly suspected other motives, such as security. Oni would want to lock down quickly if something went terribly wrong. Much of the school's design, and scale, allowed her to circumnavigate any interaction with the other species, which was her biggest concern. In fact, she could have minimal interaction with all of the other students, largely due to the class sizes and the general scope of the campus. She had seen several groups of aliens milling about the buildings and in a few of her classes, but she easily avoided them, finding the farthest possible seat in a class, even if it was in the front row. Molly fantasized that she might be able to complete the rest of her education and even leave Onyx without talking to or even having eye contact with another species. The thought gave her some measure of relief. During the last of her morning classes, Molly heard the word Hurrikok again, the same creatures Director Barton had mentioned on their approach to Onyx. Paxopolis, and the larger Trevelyan Research Facility, had a small team of Hurrikok. They worked alongside the researchers, giving them an opportunity to control and manipulate Onyx's native environments, and even to improve and repair the new structures the humans had built here. Molly had never seen a Hurrikok in person, but she had spent the better part of the previous night learning about them from the Onyx briefing vids Director Mendez had mentioned. They were living machines the Forerunners had designed millennia ago to maintain their technology. These jellyfish-like creatures of tech-imbued flesh were filled with some kind of gas that made them float. Instead of arms and legs, they had prehensile tentacles that could wield just about any tool, whether human or otherwise, according to the vids. The Covenant had apparently enslaved the Hurrikok, referring to them as engineers, while to the Forerunners they were apparently known as servant tools. To Molly, however, the images and vids made the Hurrikok look like something that belonged deep underwater. She would be perfectly fine if she never saw one in person, and part of her hoped that she wouldn't. When her grade broke for lunch, Molly made her way to the campus dining hall. As she expected, the hall was just as architecturally and technologically impressive as the rest of the school, but that didn't make it more inviting. Most of the students eating in the hall sat at round tables in groups of up to eight. Even though Molly could see pockets of friends, she was too new to identify any of the cliques she expected to find here. But she didn't suppose it mattered. None of those groups were likely to want to have much to do with her. And that was fine by her. She didn't want anything to do with them either. Her plan wasn't to make friends. It was to just get through the day, hopefully without having to interact with any other students, especially the aliens. Molly stood in line with the rest of the students to get her food, but when she looked for a place to sit down, it seemed as if every table she spotted was already occupied or spoken for. Most of the people sitting at the tables were human, but one corner of the hall seemed to have been set aside for aliens, the other species, as Kasha Hylot had reminded her. About half those were filled with Sangheili, while the rest overflowed with the smaller grunts. Glancing at them, Molly felt a familiar revulsion and anxiety rising in her stomach, just like when she'd met the Sangheili headmaster. Molly found it incredibly telling, and even alarming, that despite all of the positive ideals that had been lauded during her initial meeting with Director Mendez and his team, this room, in the middle of the most social activity of the day, told a completely different story. Part of this made her feel vindicated. Molly wasn't the only one who didn't like this idea. The aliens seemed to share her apprehension. She certainly wouldn't have been comfortable with humans and Sangheili commingling at the same tables, and the hall showed her that, at Pax Institute, little effort had likely been made at uniting the different species on Onyx. They looked as divided as ever. As Molly surveyed the hall, she spotted plenty of seats open at one of the tables at the far end of the room, right at the border between the human side and everyone else. After closer examination, however, she saw that a single Sangheili sat there, eating alone. That made Molly's decision easy. She wasn't about to sit next to him, even if that meant her skipping a meal altogether. Eventually, after navigating the full hall, she spotted an entirely empty table a little farther along that same borderland. She claimed it for her own. Mali Patel, Nation of One. This might not be a bad lunch experience after all, she dared to hope. Ignoring the other tables, Mali made quick work of her food and was just about to start her dessert when a human boy, roughly her age, came up to her table with his tray and cleared his throat. He was thin and lanky and moved as if he'd just hit a growth spurt and didn't quite know how to handle his frame. The boy had curly dark hair, deep-set brown eyes, and a crooked smile that told Mali that he was probably more uncertain than happy at the moment. "Do you mind if I sit here?" Mali didn't care what he did. She gestured to the open seats at the table. "Do you think there's room?" "Thanks." He sat down with an empty chair between them, careful not to get too close. "You're new here, right? I saw you on the transport from Earth." Now that he mentioned it, Mali had seen him there too, but had completely forgotten about it. So many people had been on the vessel, and she'd done her best to ignore most of them. "Ah, that explains it." He cocked his head at her, confused. "What do you mean?" "Why, you don't have any friends here either." "Well, I actually started here 3 days ago, which I guess means that I have a head start on you in that department." "Doesn't look like you're doing too great either." He let out a nervous laugh. "My parents keep telling me it's only a matter of time. We haven't even been here a full week, right?" "Did you have a lot of friends at your last school?" The boy hesitated for a moment, apparently unsure how much he should divulge about his past life with a total stranger. Then he shook his head. Mali had to admit that it took some guts to tell a complete stranger that you didn't have friends anywhere at all. He could have lied. He could have told her whatever he wanted. But he didn't. She realized she probably couldn't have done that right out of the gate. And she hadn't exactly been the most cordial of strangers. "Maybe there's more to him than meets the eye," she thought. "He's not an alien. So at least he has that going for him." "Me neither," Mali finally said. "Let's make that the basis of our table." His eyes lit up, and he smiled. "The thing that binds us together?" "Exactly. Outsiders only table. Insiders not welcome." It happened in an instant. Mali didn't feel so alone anymore. The two introduced themselves and chatted over lunch, and then went outside into the school's courtyard for the rest of the hour. The sky was a bright blue, and the planet they called Macintosh loomed like a solemn visage spread above them. The courtyard sat out to one side of the school, behind the main building. The area right outside the school was paved with concrete, but it eventually gave way to a wide field of trimmed grass. Benches had been scattered all around it, along with a few repulsor courts on which to play grav ball sports, such as slingshot or ricochet. The boy, Karim El-Hashem, had been living on Luna when the Covenant had first invaded the Sol system. Although Luna had been attacked by the Covenant, Earth and Mars had taken the brunt of the assault. Karim's mother was apparently an expert in Ungoy culture, and when she'd gotten the invitation to join the researchers in Onyx, they'd picked up stakes and moved the entire family, rather than try to rebuild what had been taken from them. "Ungoy," Mali said, as they strolled out into the courtyard with the rest of the students. "You mean grunts?" Karim shrugged, apparently not approving of the pejorative, and he didn't seem worried about whether Mali approved of his mother's career. "They'd probably prefer Ungoy, right?" he asked, correcting her. The two finally found a spot in the shade of a large oak-like tree overlooking a pickup grav ball game not too far off. "She's been studying them for years." "Seems like we've got plenty of live specimens for her in this place." Mali cast a glance to a group of Ungoy at the far end of the repulsor courts. "During the war, they were part of the Covenant. They may have been small, but they were still warriors. Maybe they're not as intimidating as the Megalegolo." Karim offered a knowing glance. "But there are a lot of them out there. More than most people realize." Mali suppressed a shudder at the mention of the Megalegolo. She hadn't given them a thought in months. They were creatures that had served in the Covenant during its prime, known to humans as hunters, Massive, heavily armored bipeds with an immense shield on one arm and an assault cannon on the other, hunters apparently traveled in what was referred to as bonded pairs, which meant they fought in packs of two. The most intriguing and somewhat horrifying thing about them was that they weren't actually biped aliens, but rather vast colonies of intelligent eel-like creatures that had tightly woven together to form a body. Or so the terminal vids had informed her. Oh, hold on, Molly interjected, as a horrible thought occurred to her. We don't have any hunters here in Onyx, do we? Kareem shook his head. Not as far as I can tell. But I just got here, like you. No, it's mostly humans, a nasal, high-pitched voice said immediately behind them. Plus they have a bunch of Sangheili, of course. And a few of my kind, too. Molly spun around in shock. Though it spoke with their words, whatever had snuck up behind them was not human. The thing stood about 4 feet tall, not including the large pack it wore on its back, out of which a tube snaked around to clamp over where its nose should have been. The alien's body was covered in a rigid shell, much like that of a crab, except it was a vibrant purple running toward blue. Its skinny arms and legs ended up in somewhat oversized hands and feet, and the smaller creature stared up at them with unblinking eyes, set over a lipless mouth filled with jagged teeth. It was an Ungoy. The UNSC soldiers had called this species grunts because they were forced to do much of the scut work of the Covenant during the Empire's rampage across human space. Ungoy were often used as cannon fodder, the first line to soften the enemy before the other troops were deployed. Molly didn't feel the need to have sympathy for any part of the Covenant, but she'd noted more than once that there always seemed to be so many Ungoy in combat stills. That wasn't surprising, she supposed. The Covenant probably had a constantly replenishing supply, forcing each generation to give their lives for the cause. And for 30 years... that cause had been the extinction of humanity. Hello, the Ungoy said with eerie clarity. My name's Gudam Keshun. I'm a student here, too. Molly just stared for a second. She could barely think of what to say to this creature that had caught her completely off guard. After about 5 awkward seconds, she blurted out the first thing that came to her mind. Are you in our class? Molly didn't know why she had asked that. She didn't care, and didn't want to talk any further. But it was the first thing that came to her instinctively. But Molly also found that it didn't seem to bother her to be this close to an Ungoy. Unlike the Sangheili she'd seen on Onyx, this little Ungoy seemed relatively harmless. For a moment, she had to remind herself. This was a kind of creature that had been at war with humanity not so long ago. They might even have crewed the ship that killed her parents back on Paris 4. Of course, Gudam said. That's why I'm here, right? They don't let the little ones interact with the big ones. By age and maturity, I mean, not size, right? Or I'd never be allowed anywhere near aliens as big as you, much less the Sangheili students. I think they're even born taller than the adults of my species. That must have been a joke by how much Gudam seemed to laugh at it. Though it was difficult for Molly to tell if the creature was joking or simply struggling to breathe. The thought of an Ungoy finding itself funny was intriguing enough for Molly to crack a smile. It was such a human thing to do. Gudam's in our math class, Kareem said. She's the teacher's pet. What? Molly was trying to parse what she'd just heard. Gudam was a she, which had not been obvious to Molly at all. You're only saying that because she's my mother, but she doesn't favor me more than any of the other 5 in my clutch. Other 5? Again, Molly had a hard time comprehending. Your mother's the teacher? And there are 6 of you? In my clutch, and another 4 in the younger clutch, plus another dozen from my other mother's clutch, but they're all grown and gone now. They didn't come with us. You have 2 mothers? Molly didn't know anything about Ungoy sexual preferences or mating habits. Everything Gudam was telling her was brand new. Uh-huh. And 3 fathers. But only one of them came with us to Onyx. He works as an explorer, just like my other mother, Mama Beskin. But the mother who's here, Mama Afrid, she doesn't know anything about stuff like that. You know, Forerunners and the things they built. But she didn't want to just sit around all day long being useless, so she teaches here instead. She's the best.
How come I didn't see you in math class? Molly said, slightly confused. She'd suffered through that first thing in the morning, but didn't remember seeing any Ungoy.
Or your mother, for that matter.
The man who's been teaching us the last couple days was a substitute, Kareem said. Teacher Afrid should be back in school later today.
She was home taking care of me this morning.
Gudam dug her strange foot into the grass and twisted it about, as though slightly ashamed. Another surprisingly human mannerism.
I decided to try running around outside without my breathing kit on.
She pointed at the pack on her back.
I need methane to breathe. If I don't have any, it really gets to your head after a while, you know.
Well, I suppose you don't.
Breathing all that high-powered oxygen the way you two do.
Gudam coughed a couple times after that, and Molly wondered if Gudam's voice was always that wheezy, or if it was an effect of her messing with the wrong gas in her lungs. She struggled for a moment to catch her breath, grabbing on to Kareem's arm as she did.
Then, something happened. Molly couldn't believe it at the time, but she found herself actually beginning to feel sorry for this creature. The Ungoy.
Molly tried to remind herself that this thing was part of the Covenant, or at least she would have been had the war continued. And to Molly, Gudam was as genuinely ugly as could be, almost offensively so, but even still. Something about her intrigued Molly. She found Gudam strangely adorable, but couldn't explain why.
How old are you?
Molly asked, again not quite sure where the question came from. It seemed entirely logical, despite the completely illogical nature of the conversation's participants.
What kind of small talk is one supposed to have with an alien?
I just turned 5,
Gudam said brightly. As humans count years, at least.
We had a big party for me and all my clutch mates.
Gudam again started laughing loudly, attracting the attention of other students. She would have probably continued if another fierce coughing fit hadn't stopped her again.
Just 5?
Molly could hardly believe it. Gudam seemed to be about the same size as the other Ungoy Molly had seen in the dining hall.
Ungoy grow to maturity rather quickly, Kareem said. I think Teacher Afrid is actually only 10 years old.
That's right, Gudam said. But she doesn't look a day over 8.
Molly had a hard time reconciling Gudam with what she'd known about grunts before coming to Onyx, the little she'd learned through news feeds and Waypoint articles. She zeroed in on a loose fact, something obscure that had frightened her when she first heard it. Some grunts would make suicide runs, charging into a group of humans and activating plasma grenades. The Ungoy may have been cannon fodder, but they'd killed a lot of people. But Gudam didn't seem dangerous at all.
Had there been Ungoy on the ships that had destroyed Paris 4?
Molly wondered once more.
Almost definitely. And they'd likely murdered millions during the war, including my sister and my parents.
The thoughts were sobering, but it was where Molly's mind went. Gudam hadn't been on one of those enemy vessels, but if the war had still been going on, she could have wound up on a ship like that, doing what those who came before her did, trying desperately to kill more humans. Maybe even trying to kill me. But instead, this strange alien was cracking jokes and acting friendly, and that strange shift made Molly's stomach twist.
So who are you?
Gudam stuck her hand out to Molly.
Any friend of Kareem's is a friend of mine.
Gudam lowered her voice in confidence.
I hear that's the kind of thing humans say to each other. I've been reading on the side to catch up.
Molly hesitated for a moment, but then she took the little creature's large hand and shook it. At first, Molly was nervous. The Ungoy had thick, clawed hands that vaguely reminded Molly of a crab's pincers. She wondered if she'd even get her hand back in one piece. Yet, despite the roughness of Gudam's shell, her touch was surprisingly gentle and light. She shook Molly's hand with what seemed to be sincere glee.
I'm Molly.
Hello, Molly. You're only the second human I've done this with. Most people get uncomfortable, you know. I don't blame them. I mean, you humans are so soft and fleshy. You need to protect your skin. But I think I see why you do this among yourselves. Shake hands, I mean. It's fun to make contact like this, isn't it?
The young boy's mouth spread into a wide smile, showing every one of her vicious teeth. Molly did her best not to think of what it would feel like to have those things sink into her soft and fleshy skin.
I suppose so.
A slight grin appeared on Molly's face, without her intending it. The three turned at a sound, hearing someone snarl behind them.
Damn hinge heads, an angry boy said. We ought to space the lot of them, one at a time.
Molly tried to assess what she was seeing. A trio of large boys were stalking toward a single Sangheili, who was standing off to one side of the courtyard by himself. She didn't know how well Sangheili ears worked, but she could easily hear the boy's words and was twice as far away from him as the alien. Still, the Sangheili didn't acknowledge the human. He just kept his head down and seemed to ignore the kid. Molly recognized the Sangheili as the same one she saw sitting by himself in the dining hall, the one she'd refused to sit with. Most of the elites were challenging to tell apart here, shades of browns and grays. This Sangheili was different, though. Its skin was paler than that of most of the others, almost white. The alien definitely stood out from the other members of its species, at least on Onyx. Some humans who had been near the Sangheili moved away from him as the three boys approached. The one in the lead was buff and burly, with short cropped hair. He looked as if he could be a marine in training. The two who followed in his wake were cut from the same mold. They were each shorter and smaller than him, though not by much, and they wore the same dark scowls.
"Uh-oh," Kareem said in a low voice meant only for Molly's ears. "That's Karl Zakovsky. And that's his brother Zeb and their friend Andre Malez."
"Their trouble?" she asked.
"Biggest bullies in the school, from what I can tell. They haven't picked on me yet, but I've been steering clear of them."
"That's not easy to do in a school this size," Gudam said. She stared openly at the troublemakers as they went by a few paces away.
"Eventually, the people who want to find you will find you."
Karl strode up to where the Sangheili stood with his back to them, looking out across a field and into the forest just outside the school grounds. The boy reached out and shoved the alien in the shoulder, almost knocking him to the ground.
"Watch where you're walking," Karl said to the alien.
Instead of moving past him, though, Karl stopped and cackled as the Sangheili staggered forward and then caught himself.
"Yeah," Zeb said, echoing his brother. "Watch where you're walking."
The Sangheili turned around slowly and gave each of the boys a dead-eyed stare. He stretched out to his full height so he could look each of them in the eye. They were older than him, maybe, and taller, but he easily outmassed each of them. Molly's apprehension about the aliens aside, she knew how this could end. In a fair fight, the Sangheili could probably take down any one of those boys, even Karl, but they clearly weren't interested in making this a fair fight. She scanned the courtyard to see if any faculty were around to stop this, but not a single adult was in sight.
"I was standing still."
The Sangheili's voice was higher than she expected, but she hadn't heard too many voices from his species before. She wondered if he was a younger fledgling. Kasha was the first Sangheili who had ever spoken to Molly in person. Before that, the most she'd ever heard came from news feeds with Sangheili such as the Arbiter, the leader of the Swords of Sanghelios, giving a speech. His own elites had claimed to be humanity's allies since the end of the war. He often spoke in delegations and peace conferences between his government and the UEG. As intimidating as the Sangheili were, the Arbiter had a magnificent voice, deep and resonant. The Arbiter and his Swords of Sangheelios stood out as the shining example Molly's new parents often used, to prove the Sangheili weren't inherently evil, even if they'd been deceived by the prophets into attacking humanity for nearly 30 years. To Molly, that made little difference. She understood her new parents' interpretation of the events, but she didn't think that being fooled into murdering millions of people got you off the hook for murdering millions of people. They were still responsible for what they had done. With the war stopped, are we supposed to just act like it never happened? Molly's parents and sister were still dead. How am I supposed to deal with that?
Then watch where we're walking, Carl.